Good evening. And tonight's talk is usually a talk that I love to give at the end of the retreat so that we talk about how to have a transition from retreat into daily life. And so I gave this talk in August and I was all prepared to give it, and then I decided to switch up a little bit to follow on the Insight Dialogue, as well as to create a context from which we are to go home and to continue to practice. And so one of the practices I want to encourage us to do even this evening is the art of listening. And so I know you've had some exercises with that, just being able to equanimity and to feel the sensations in your body. And I talked about it in my first talk about wisdom begins in wonder and the unwillingness to let things speak to us in its own language. So I would like to propose that, and so I'm going to start off. So I'll start off reading a few things, which is not what I normally do, but I think it sets the context in which we want to have this discussion about practice in daily life. So the great physicist David Bohm knew this: if we are to live in harmony with ourselves and with nature, he wrote in his excellent and timely treatise on the paradox of communication, we need to be able to communicate freely in a creative movement in which no one permanently holds to or otherwise defends his own ideas. And so Eric Fromm came up with these six, what does he call them? The six rules for listening. So I'm going to read from him. So he says, listening, Fromm argues, is an art like the understanding of poetry, and like any art, has its own rules and norms. Drawing on his half-century practice as a therapist, Fromm offers six such guidelines for mastering the art of unselfish understanding. I'm going to read that again. Mastering the art of unselfish understanding. So number one, the basic rule, and I don't expect you to remember all these, but it's forming a context, and you're going to see a parallel to what we've been doing. Number one, the basic rule for practicing this art is the complete concentration of the listener. I suppose you heard that a couple of times this week, and you probably heard it again today. So the complete concentration on the listener. Number two, nothing of importance must be on his or her, I'll say, on one's mind, because everything here is in the masculine, so I'm going to change it a little bit. Nothing of importance must be on one's mind. One must be optimally free from anxiety as well as from greed. So you heard those two words before, I imagine. Number three, he must possess a freely working imagination which is sufficiently concrete to be expressed in words. Number four, one must be endowed with the capacity for empathy with another person and strong enough to feel the experience of the other as if it were one's own. Number five, the condition for such empathy is a crucial facet of the capacity for love. Joseph talked about love and understanding last night a little bit, as we all have over the week. To understand another means to love him, and not in the erotic sense, but in the sense of reaching out to him and of overcoming the fear of losing oneself. And number six, understanding and love are inseparable. If they are separate, it is a cerebral process and the door to essential understanding remains closed. So just think about these six rules for listening, and it's what we've been practicing, being in a body and just observing experience, creating that space between stimulus and response, and just listening and whatever vibrations are happening in the body, just noticing them, but still staying open to hear what is saying, what is being said in its own language. So now I'm going to switch over to a book that was written by Thomas Friedman, New York Times. It's called Thank You for Being Late. And so it talks about the context in which we are operating our society. And so he says, meanwhile, a research study for the University of Oxford's Martin School concluded in 2003 that 47% of American jobs are at high risk of being taken by computers within the next two decades. I suspect that might have been sped up a little bit. So I'm going to read this. So what those numbers tell you is that in the age of accelerations, everyone is going to have to raise their game in the classroom and for their whole lifetime. What those numbers tell you is that we truly cannot afford to leave any child behind anymore. What those numbers tell you is that pluralism matters more than ever going forward, because on current trends, America will become a majority non-white community over the next quarter century. Yet, without having worked out our racial issues, the foreshocks are being felt right now. And with more migrants fleeing zones of disorder, this problem will only become more acute across the globe. Therefore, societies that can truly make out of many one will have so much more political stability, not to mention innovative prowess. What those numbers also tell you is that leadership matters more than ever at the political and personal levels, but a particular kind of leadership at the national and local levels. We need a leadership that can promote inclusion and adaptation. A leadership that starts every day asking, what world am I living in? And how do I engage in the relentless pursuit of the best practices with a level of energy and smarts commensurate with the magnitude of the challenges and the opportunities in this age of accelerations? It is also a leadership that trusts the people with the truth about this moment, that just working hard and playing by the rules won't suffice anymore to produce a decent life. That's why leadership also matters more now on a personal level. Back in the 1960s, in places like Minnesota, we had so much wind at our backs that you needed a plan to fail. No more. Now you need a plan to succeed, a plan for lifelong learning and skills growth. That means more personal leadership, more of everyone taking ownership of their own future and embracing the startup of you, which means, you know, you're your own CEO of your own company. It is not too late for any of us, let alone America, to manifest the kind of leadership. But as the environmentalist Dana Meadows used to say about mitigating climate change, we have exactly enough time starting now and not a moment less, because the margin for mistakes or delays is shrinking on every front for every nation and every person. I repeat, when the world is fast, if you get off course, as a leader, a teacher, a student, an investor, an employee, you can find yourself with a very long road back. Small errors in navigation can have really serious consequences when the market, that's one, Mother Nature, that's two, and Moore's Law, which is this law that says that computing power doubles every 2 years. I'll say that again, computing power doubles every 2 years. So the technological changes are accelerating extremely fast. I'll read it again. When the market, Mother Nature, and Moore's laws are all accelerating at this speed. Finally, philosophically speaking, I have been struck by how many of the best solutions for helping people build resilience and propulsion, of course I use the word self-efficacy, in the age of accelerations are things you cannot download, but have to upload the old-fashioned way, one human to another human at a time. Looking back on all my interviews for this book, how many times and how many different contexts did I hear about the vital importance of having a caring adult or mentor in every young person's life? How many times did I hear about the value of having a coach? I didn't put that in there. It was in there. Whether you are applying for a job for the first time at Walmart or running Walmart. How many times did I hear people stressing the importance of self-motivation and practice and taking ownership of your own career or education as the real differentiators for success? How interesting was it to learn that the highest paying jobs, and this is extremely important, the highest paying jobs in the future will be STEMpathy jobs, STEMpathy jobs. Jobs that combine strong science and technological skills with the ability to empathize with another human being. Wow. So just seeing that, there's more to read, but just think about what we've been doing. the Brahma Vihara practices, this idea of being awake, this idea of really seeing things as they are and then adapting and adjusting to them. So I'm going to read a little bit more. How ironic was it to learn that something as simple as a chicken coop or the basic planting of trees and gardens could be the most important thing we do to stabilize parts of the world of disorder. However, whoever would have thought it would be a national security and personal security imperative for all of us to scale the golden rule further and wider than ever. And who can deny that when individuals get so super empowered and interdependent at the same time, it becomes more vital than ever to be able to look into the face of your neighbor or the stranger or the refugee or the migrant and see in that person a brother or sister. Who can ignore the fact that the key to Tunisia's success in the Arab Spring was that it had a little bit more civil society than any other Arab country, not cell phones or Facebook friends? How many times and in how many different contexts did people mention to me the word trust between two human beings as the true enabler of all good things? And whoever thought that the key to building a healthy community would be a dining room table? That's why I'm not surprised that when I asked Surgeon General Murtha what was the biggest disease in America today, without hesitation he answered, "It's not cancer, it's not heart disease, it's isolation. It is the pronounced isolation that so many people are experiencing that is the great pathology of our lives today." How ironic. We are the most technologically connected generation in human history, and yet more people feel more isolated than ever. This only reinforces Murtha's earlier point that the connections that matter most are in most short supply today, and they are human to human connections. And so I could read on, but I think that's enough to kind of think about what it is we're up against. And I didn't read this to bum you out or anything like that. I read this to say that this is what's happening. So all of us have been talking about impermanence. But right here, he's talking about accelerated impermanence. And that what happens is it takes us about 10 years to adjust to new changes. And so you might look at Obamacare and realize it's been almost 10 years and now people realize they want it. And the ironic thing is a platform only lasts 5 years. So if it takes us 10 years to adapt, you can see the problem with that, right? We get further and further behind. And so this idea of, and people have been asking me this, or asking us this, how do we continue this practice when we go home? And so if we're going home and if we're trying to enhance more inclusion and adaptation, then a lot of the practices that we've been doing here, and even this one practice of just listening, just what would happen if we actually listen to each other instead of talk at each other? What would happen if we listen to ourselves? And so this idea of what we're doing and what are the practices we need to do, we've been doing them all week. And you got a introduction this afternoon with Jill with the Insight Dialogue. How many of you folks were in the Insight Dialogue today at one point or another? Okay, so there were a lot of folks, right? And so the idea is that from the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep, you can practice. So sitting and being aware and watching and observing the breath is great and it's important and stability is important. But what's more important is the continuity of practice Joseph was talking about. And it's interesting because what I hear Thomas Friedman saying is, we got to get beyond the illusion of separateness. Joseph talked about no self. Another way of observing that or thinking about that is the illusion of separateness. That I and the other are one. Self and other are one. If one person is suffering, we all are suffering. If one person is free, then hopefully there's hope for all of us. to be free. So the vision of possibility I have is that we've had an amazing several days together, and that why not build on that, and why not realize that you've been taught things, and so what are some of the things, and this is a rhetorical question, what are some of the practices that you've engaged in, some of the learnings you had about yourself and about the process, can you take home with you? And like even now, just listening and realizing, because to me, I'm reading this and there's shivers going all through me. Some of it is traumatic. Some of it is excitement. Yet I have to talk and I have to discuss this stuff. So on one hand, I'm excited. On the other hand, it's painful. But from this equanimous place, or what I call the eye of the hurricane, I can hold both and just really realize that this is not really about me. This is about us. And it's about us really getting honest about what's happening, and that it's a daunting challenge, but we're up for it. And that his whole idea of this idea of being a lifelong learner, that's another way of saying pursuing excellence and wisdom with grace and ease, that's really important. And this idea of trust, think about that. When we took the precepts and the refuges, and we look at the Eightfold Noble Path, and we talk about right speech, right action, right livelihood. So if we have right view, which is we are all connected, and that, let's just say love, because love kept coming up in our discussions. So if we have a mind full of love, then our thoughts and our intentions are going to be loving. And if our thoughts and intentions are loving, then our speech, our actions, our livelihood are going to be loving. And then our right effort is going to be the right effort, because it's starting off with the right view. It's conditioned by right view and right intention, which means the mindfulness is going to be right and the concentration is going to be right. And so that's way too simple. But it's really what it comes down to. And so I always ask the question, what do we want? Or it said here, what kind of world are we living in? Who are we being, and where are we going? And so if you think about the practice, there's so much we can do just having right view. Just noticing that if you have an unwholesome mind state like greed, hatred, or delusion, it's going to be problematic. And that we talked, all of us have been talking different aspects of the practice, but really what it comes down to is changing our minds and realizing that this is a lifelong process, learning, growth, and development. And so, once again, going back to the wisdom begins in wonder, this idea that we have a life that we can live where moment to moment, we're being on the path, and we're not struggling, we're actually thriving, and we're actually experiencing wonderful feelings. So this is from David Hawkins. It's called Discover the Presence of God, Non-Dualistic Duality. He says, that brings up the quote, the unexamined life is not worth living. So here's his answer. Although the quotation might seem to be somewhat of an overstatement, it does contain a valuable truth and observation, which is also validated by the premises of quantum mechanics, the Heisenberg principle, in quotes, and that observation itself changes outcome as a consequence of not only the introduction of the field of consciousness, but also its intention. To a highly aware person, you think there's any of us in here? Most people seem to walk about as if they are in some kind of dream state, unconscious and unaware of themselves. Self-observation leads to awakening, which then motivates the desire to learn, grow, mature, and evolve. Self-inquiry leads to discovery and the unfolding of the layers that obscure the self. With self-inquiry, one examines the basis for faith and beliefs, and by instituting spiritual techniques and criteria, proceeds to discover the inner validation of spiritual truths for oneself. Thus, the field of inquiry is the function of consciousness / awareness and the manner in which it contextualizes the inner experience of self, others, and divinity. There is a difference between having heard a truth and having discovered it as an inner reality. The way to be it is to own it as an experiential reality. Sound familiar? That's what we've been talking about. It's like the Buddha says, see for yourself. You don't have to believe, but check it out. Investigate, inquire. And we talk about it. So I wanted to talk about those things, and I don't know if I want to say too much because I know I've thrown a lot at you. But at the same time, it's like your life is your practice. Your life is your practice. So it's not like, okay, I'm on retreat and I can really investigate and explore. No, the whole time. From the time you wake up to the time you go to sleep, you can check in and say, well, what's my attitude like? How does my body feel? What am I observing and how does the mind feel? And what kind of thoughts am I having? Are those thoughts consistent with being loving or being compassionate, being generous? Do I see myself as separate from others? So it's interesting because we can get into a conversation of self or no self, right? But I remember this this quote from this psychologist, and this patient said, it was my unconscious that did it. You know, almost like the old show with Flip Wilson when he said, the devil made me do it. So the therapist said, so whose unconscious is it? So there is this idea of, yeah, there is self, there is no self, but there's karma or this volitional action. And so what we do makes a difference. And so when we understand that, we understand, yeah, okay, we can get into the mechanics, but we make choices. We are thinking. And those thoughts are either making things, they're either an investment or spending energy. Or they're even leading to peace, harmony, or they're leading to fear, doubt, and insecurity. And so it's a really simple process of what we've been doing here is being in your body. And it's interesting because that's really one of the things we've been teaching ourselves is how to be in the body and have the body anchor us in the present moment. And just feel whatever's there. Once again, the equanimity you were practicing earlier. Okay, what's there? What's the vibration? Just being able to feel that and not get into the story about it, to not get into the concept. So that very simply put, that we have this ability to just observe what's going on. If we can create space between stimulus and response, and we can ask ourselves, you know, if what we're going to do, is that going to be harmful to myself and others? And if it's to be harmful for me or to someone else or to both of us, it's not to be done. And sometimes we're doing something and we don't know and we can ask, is this harmful? Is this working? Is it not working? And if it's not working, then we can pause and say, okay, so either I'm going to play this through and then learn from it. Because remember I said the other day, there's no such thing as failure, just feedback. Then it's telling us what we have to learn, what we have to practice, what we need to experience. And so even after the fact, we can reflect on, well, how did that go? What was helpful? What was not helpful? And so we can always ask this inquiry. So those folks out there that say meditation is not thinking, what they're really saying is meditation is not negative thinking, but positive thinking, asking ourselves questions like, you know, what am I doing? So we talk about there's what we call clear comprehension and mindfulness. So mindfulness, we talk about bare awareness and we just stay with the bare sensations and we deal with the sensations and it can stop us from getting into the thoughts about it and then actually getting into to behavior. So if we generate enough hatred where we're actually feeling like doing something, we have the precepts to remind us that, okay, no, that's not to be done because it's harmful. So we can have that pause in there and think about it. And even if we do the deed, we can apologize and then say, okay, all I need to do is get back on my aim to be more loving. And so a part of the practice can be as simple as just watching your reactions to life. And that would tell you how you were being. So we use the word love. So if I'm not being so loving to you, if my reaction is, you know, it may not be as strong as hate, but it's kind of like sarcasm or something like that. If I just watch my reactions to how I'm relating to her, then I can go back and say, well, okay, so what was my mindset? So I had wrong view, I had wrong thoughts, or I had an unwholesome mind state that I didn't catch in time. And so if I catch the unwholesome mind state and if I know where that's leading, then I can do something about it. So it's as simple as, and I'm reading the text now, and it says, again, it says, talking about the mindfulness, contemplation of the body. It says, mindfulness that there is a body is established in one to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and continuous mindfulness. And he and one abides independent, not clinging to anything in the world. That too is how the regard, that's how in regard to the body, he one abides contemplating the body. So think about that. So just to the extent that bare awareness and continuity of mindfulness. So your body is always doing something, going somewhere. And it says, again, bhikkhus, when going forward or returning, he one acts clearly knowing. When looking ahead or looking away, one acts clearly knowing. When flexing and extending one's limbs, one acts clearly knowing. When wearing one's robes or clothes and carrying one's outer robe and bow, one acts clearly knowing. When eating, drinking, consuming food, and tasting, one acts clearly knowing. When defecating and urinating, one acts clearly knowing. They didn't leave anything out. When walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, waking up, talking, and keeping silent, one acts clearly knowing. That's in the Satipatthana Sutta. I'm not making that up. So that's it. So whatever you're doing, so when you did mindful movement, or Erwin, or if you do Tai Chi, or you're just walking or doing your job, there's an opportunity to practice. And you don't need, as Joseph talked about, you don't need all this driving effort. All you need is just a little, just movement. And, you know, you can always feel it, okay? Just easy does it, but do it. And so this is what's possible for us. So I can give you all of these, you know, the Eightfold Noble Path and the Five Spiritual Powers, but really it comes down to be here now. And just notice what's going on and notice if it's what you're doing is helpful or not. And you look at it from the context of a mental action, which is what? Your thoughts. As, you know, Gandhi said it, you know, you can see your beliefs, or is what they call a deterministic screen. So a deterministic screen or filter helps you to see some things, but it prevents you from seeing other things. So if this deterministic screen is one of a physician, then what I'm looking at is going to be consistent with what a physician is looking at. Go and watch your blood pressure and, you know, and all of those things that physicians look at. But there's going to be other things you can't see. So we have to at least know we got on a deterministic screen that's allowing us to see some things and not others. And then we might have to create a new screen if we're going to see new things. And so that filter, that we can look at that as attitude or right view. And Gandhi said, our beliefs become our thoughts. Our thoughts become our words. Our words become our actions. Our actions become our habits. Our habits become our values. And our values become our destiny. So that's an equation. So if I want love, my value is love, then I can work backwards. But I have a belief that says I am capable of love. The person I'm looking at is capable of love. And if I say love is wholesome, then if my belief is everybody deserves to be loved, or let's take a radical approach that we all want. Well, that's interesting. And so now we love each other. And so your thoughts are going to be loving, your words are going to be loving, your actions are going to be loving, your habit's going to be a habit of loving, and your value is love, and destination is love. And so that's how simple and complex that is. I think Joseph said, the teacher said, simple but not easy. You know, and it's interesting, I kept asking Jill for her quote because I kept forgetting it. And she said, if it's in the way, it is the way. Right? So, and we talk about it in the sports world. If all the obstacles that come up in the game is the game. So you have an official that you know, you come down to the end of the game and say the score is, you're up by you're losing by 2 points. And you have an official, the person that makes calls, that can give you the ball or lose the ball. And the official can make a call, and he makes a call, and you lose the game. And you can say, oh, it's the official's fault. And what I used to say to the teams I work with was like, okay, yeah, you could say that. But there was a whole lot of plays before that that if you'd have made, it wouldn't have come down to that. But here's the other thing. If you know the officials are not going to give you the call, then you got to make that part of the game. So you say, okay, so how about having a 10-point lead with a minute to go, and the official can call whatever they want? That's not how I say it, but I'm cleaning it up a little bit. That's what it is. And so if you're dealing with somebody and they don't like you, or if they're treating you mean, and you go in there acting like they're not going to do that, and you know they're going to do that, then you got to make that part of the game. And you say, okay, they're not going to respect me, but I have to respect myself. And if I know that, I can just be in that equanimity and notice what it feels like. Then at some point, you might decide to get away from that person. But in the interim, if you have to deal with them, then we have to figure out how we can respond to what's happening and not react to it. So there's so much here to talk about, or, you know, I've said it, and, you know, I can go through it, but I'm there's a lot there. But let me just summarize by saying, going over and I couldn't find this paper the other night, but it's like the five hindrances, right? So we have sensual desire, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, doubt. So we've been, I would say, what do you think the favorite of the week is? Sloth and torpor or sensual desire? What do you think? Sloth and torpor, is that a good one? Yeah. Okay, so here's the remedy. Here's how you develop the opposite of that. Lessening food intake. Did anybody do that one? Change in meditation postures. I know that's been done. Mental clarity, cognition of light, staying outdoors. Well, that's a good one right now, but go outside. I guarantee you won't have sloth and torpor. And then the other one is good friends and suitable conversation. So what is good friends and suitable conversation? That's exactly what we've been doing all week. So we referred to teachers as a good friend, and Sangha members as good friends, and we're having suitable conversation. Conversation like, how can we deal with this accelerated change in a way where we can be more inclusive and have adaptation and be willing to keep learning and growing and knowing the truth and then relating to the truth in a way where we have opportunities and we are growing and we are evolving and we're up for the challenge. So that's just one of them. But it's interesting because all of those sensual desires, the same thing, is general acquaintance with formal meditation on the body's unattractiveness. Has anybody been doing that one? Probably not. Guarding the sense doors. We talked about that. When I said, when seen only the seen, and Joseph talked about knowing in the object, and we also talked about when pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, we can just be with the sensation and the mental noting can help us to have space around it. And so it says moderation in food. That one keeps coming up. Good friends and suitable conversation. Interesting. That one is on all of them. Good. So just think about that. So you're not here. And someone wrote a note about what's the value of a teacher, or what's the value of a good friend, the value of a good friend and the teacher. Like I read before, we need coaches. We need people. And there's another part on there that I didn't read that's really important. But we need others to tell us or to remind us that we're okay. Right? And so that's what we need. And so there's another part that probably makes sense for me to read. Okay, here it says, so he says, I am hardly a technophobe, but we will get the best of these technologies only if we don't let them distract us from making these deep human connections. Addressing these deep human longings and inspiring these deep human energies. And whether we do that depends on all the stuff you can't download. The high five from a coach, the praise from a mentor, the hug from a friend, the hand up from a neighbor, the handshake from a rival, the totally unsolicited gesture of kindness from the stranger, the smell of a garden, and not the cold stare of a wall. That's saying a lot. So just think about that. It's one of the practices I have when I work with folks, especially with teams. I call it catch yourself or your teammate doing something right. That we always focus on what's wrong, and I don't know. In my generation, it's interesting, the young kids now, they want to have a relationship with their coaches and their parents and all of that stuff. When I was growing up, if you had to talk to dad or the coach, you were in trouble. And if you were doing your job, they didn't say nothing. You were supposed to do your job. What do you want me to give you something for what you're supposed to be doing? That didn't happen. And so I'm not saying that's the way to go, but I know from what we call the Lasada line, if you want somebody to be excellent at something, the ratio to positive feedback to correctional feedback needs to be somewhere around 5-1. And you can't be making it up. It's got to be real. And so just think about how sensitive we are when we speak to each other and when we encourage each other, not to encourage each other like my godson. He played on teams. Everybody got trophies. I'm not talking about that. You show up, you get a trophy. Now, you know, so, and you know you didn't earn it. It's really, you know, and I'm not against trying to build up self-esteem or whatever, but it has to work. It can't be a feel-good. People have to earn this stuff. And so we reap what we sow. And so just these things, just if you just practice from moment to moment, what's your mind doing? What's it focused on? How's it feeling? What are your thoughts like, especially that inner dialogue? And if you watch yourself, then your uncritical observation of your reactions to life is telling you who you are being. And so if you have an aim and you're not doing what you aim, all you got to do is say, mea culpa, whatever it is, I'm sorry, and then get back on aim, on track, get back on purpose. And so maybe I'll end with just saying, you know, you folks have heard of clear comprehension of mindfulness, you know, purpose, what's your intention, what is it you're trying to do, suitability, what's the best way to do it, domain of practice. That's all day. So for all day during the day, you have to keep the object of your mindfulness in mind. And so we've been working on the breath in the body. So they're there. If they're not there, you're not there. And then the last thing is, you know, we talked about impermanence, suffering or dukkha, and no self. But I refer to it because it keeps me out of heated conversations. I say the illusion of separateness. And every once in a while, we can experience that. And I know 2013, when they had the marathon bombing. And they had two explosions. And the interesting thing was that people were running towards the explosion, not away. And you saw it when we have, you know, the crisis in Puerto Rico and Texas and Southern California with the mudslides, or California and the forest and the fires, that people were reaching out, going out, putting themselves in jeopardy. I read about this young man who was a military guy. He's a young man. He went into the house four or five times to rescue people in a fire, and the fifth time, the last time, he ended up perishing. But this is what we do when we realize I and the other are one. When we get beyond that veil of separateness, we're able to just go and do what we need to do to support each other. And so, I'm going to do, because I want to balance it out a little bit, I'm going to do one of the two factors of enlightenment, or maybe the first three. So mindfulness and clear knowledge, avoiding unmindful people and associating with mindful people, inclining the mind accordingly towards the development of sati, or mindfulness. This is investigation, theoretical inquiry. Now, I won't mention his name, but there's a dude here that me and him have this inquiry every morning for breakfast. We go at it. We talk to each other. He's smiling now. But it's a fascinating interaction. And then bodily cleanliness and balancing the five spiritual powers, which I talked about, avoiding unwise people and associating with wise people, reflecting on the deeper aspects of the Dharma and inclining the mind accordingly. So to me, it's like investigating. This is what Joseph was talking about, just looking at stuff, and then asking questions and reading the practices, listening to Dharma, like what we're doing now. And then energy, that's the one I talked about the other day, reflecting on the fearfulness of the plains of misery, seeing the benefits of effort, reflecting on the path to be practiced, honoring the offerings one has received, reflecting on the inspiring qualities of the tradition one is following, one's teacher, one's status as a follower of the Buddha and of companions in the holy life, avoiding lazy people and associating with energetic people, inclining the mind accordingly. So we have these practices, and the question becomes, can we take them up in daily life? You don't have to do a lot of them, just maybe one or two. But once again, being in the body, I talk about that all the time, the five spiritual powers. When you're efforting, this is talk about efforting. If you're trying too hard, then you need to back off a little bit. And part of that is you have poise, or steadiness of mind. How you get steadiness of mind? By reflecting on things so that you don't have what we call greed, hatred, and delusion in the mind, but just noticing, not forgetting the present moment, and not forgetting what we're doing, and not being distracted by likes and dislikes, or where we want to go or what we don't want. And so you balance effort with poise or calmness, and then there's faith with wisdom. And mindfulness cultivates those qualities, but it also balances them. And so I talk about balancing the five spiritual powers. I mean, you can do that anytime. Everything we do, how much effort are we using? Are we really present? Not forgetting the present, not forgetting what we're doing, and having some idea of information or some idea of what we're doing and how to do it. You could call that clearly knowing, from a little bit to deep knowing. So you might say that wisdom and the awareness is working all the time, to the degree that we have some idea of what it is we're doing. So I think I want to end there in terms of what I've said, and I'm a little bit ambivalent here about opening it up for questions, because we only have 5 minutes and I know somebody's going to be upset, but I'm going to risk it and open it up. And so I'll take a few questions. Yes, ma'am. Yeah, does the center have a list of instructors and sitting groups in other cities? They used to. I don't know if they still do, but we could find out for you and make that information available.
George's Buddhist Insight Network.
Oh, okay, the Buddhist Insight Network.
Online.
Online has all that information. Thank you, Joe. You getting an assist? Anyone else have any questions? Okay. Oh, yeah. Matt, what's up?
Can you talk about your habits with your phone and how you say stay mindful about your phone usage?
How do I stay mindful with my phone usage? All depends on who's calling me. if it's a client, you know, I'm teasing you. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah, does your phone think? Does your phone make choices? No. Okay. So here's what I'm saying. It's not so much what you're doing, it's the quality of mind you have when you're doing it that's really important, and being clear about if you're using it or is it using you. In other words, is it another hideout? Because you can decide, okay, so even if you have to answer the phone, what if you let it ring a couple of times before you answer it and just kind of breathe and think about getting yourself collected, and then just listening. We talked about listening practice, listening to who's on the phone and what you need to do. But I'm not really sure if that's what you're talking about. You're talking about your relationship with the phone?
Sure.
Yeah, so what is your relationship with the phone?
It's between texting, email, phone calls, work, personal. Mm-hmm. It's everything that flows through there.
Yeah, so what's the problem? Right. So let me give you an example. So I have a friend of mine, really dear friend, and she has grandchildren. And I was out in L.A. visiting her, and I was working with her grandson. You know, I just took him outside and was teaching him how to shoot free throws. But it was really more about me calming him down and talking to him about paying attention, what we're doing here. And so I noticed that I didn't really give his sister a lot of time. So I said, okay, the next time I come, I'm going to sit and talk with you. And so we sat, we had a conversation, and her grandmother said to me, that's the first time she sat and talked to somebody without being on her phone, without texting and doing all the other stuff. And so what is that? What am I saying? What I'm saying is you can say, okay, so I'm going to take 5 minutes where I don't answer the phone unless it's an emergency, or if you can do that. You can just like you get some people gave up their phone here. You can start to devise times what you're going to answer and who you're going to text. But also, you might have to get that quadrant that Stephen Curry talks about, where some things are urgent and not important, and there's some things that are not urgent but important. And you just have to prioritize, you know, what are you doing and how do you want to use your time with the phone, and differentiate between answering certain emails and texts and ones you have to because that's your business, then you commit to doing them. But you can do them in a way where you can do them one at a time and just really be clear about, okay, what's my intention when I'm texting? What message am I giving? So your mind state is still going to be the most important thing. And also, because when you get clear, you might realize you're doing some things you don't want to do. And then at some point, you might decide just not to do that. But if it's your job, like for me, I'm up here on retreat. I have clients. And if they call me, if there's an emergency, I have to get back to them. Or if my family calls because my brother's in the hospital, I mean, I don't really want to answer the phone, but I have to answer that one. You understand what I'm saying? You get what I'm saying? So I'm not giving you a way out. I'm just saying, what do you want? And then you got to decide how to relate to your phone, have a relationship with your phone where you can do things with other people. Because if you want to develop relationships, and if you're talking to somebody, because I have people that do that, I'll be talking to them and they're texting or whatever, and I have to tell them, If you don't put the phone down, I'm not going to talk to you. So does that answer your, you get what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. How are we doing for time? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. I was wondering how much importance you would give to sitting meditation in the big picture of your overall practice. Mm-hmm. For example, could I engage in regular intensive movement meditation like through Tai Chi, mm-hmm. or through running or swimming, and also regularly read the Dharma, mm-hmm. Reframing the cognitive elements, without having a formal sitting practice, but read many of the benefits?
Yeah, so here's the thing. What do you call having a sitting formal practice?
Sitting meditation, regularly.
Mm-hmm. So, to me, I would always look and try to think of if that's, is that aversion?
Aversion to sitting?
Yeah.
Movement just easier to let the conversation
flow. Okay. So you're interested in practice that's easy.
Well, and practice that I feel like I enjoy moving my body.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get a lot of that since I'm sitting all day like at a desk anyway. So,
okay.
Two birds, one seed kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. So here's the interesting thing. So if I think sitting and being still is important. So even if you have a practice where you sit for 2 minutes a day or 2 minutes here, 2 minutes there, like you're at your desk and you're doing all that stuff, if you just sat there with your eyes open and just sat and breathed and just feel your body, just like we've been talking about, so there's no difference between sitting and observing your body than moving and doing movement and moving your body. It's the same drill. You got the body, and like I said, it's moving, so you know it's moving. It's sitting there. It's answering the phone. It's doing this. That you can just be in your body and breathe. And what you'll find is if you make 2 minutes to sit, you'll probably get 5 or 10. And just deal with that, whatever it is, the unpleasantness or whatever, and just sit. Because to me, I think that we it's important that you have some stability of mind. And so, and sometimes, like I do Tai Chi, I do Qigong and all that stuff. And sometimes after I do it, I'll sit and breathe and just feel my body and notice what it feels like. And just maybe that can be part of your stillness practice. Because my Sifu used to talk about moving and stillness and movement. So it's really more about how do you slow down. Are you right-handed or left-handed?
Right-handed.
Right-handed, okay. So when you sit and you're still and you're just sitting, what you do is the active left side of your brain slows down so that your right side can get a word in edgewise. So if you think about it, just from the nourishment it gives, your ability to balance your brain, and also just the fact that sitting and breathing, you get to understand how your body feels, so there might be something there that will help you when you go to do your movement, that you have more, you're more in your body. So I would just play with that. Just think and try it for 30 days and see what happens. And if you don't like it, you can go back. But I think if I'm working with somebody and they say they don't want to do something like Joseph would do to me, I'd say you need to do it. Not that I would force you, but I would suggest not strongly, but just try it and see. Because here's what you're training. You're not just doing it just to be kind of a grim thing. What you're also doing is realizing that there's things you don't want to do, and you got to develop the discipline to get comfortable with being uncomfortable. And sometimes because we're moving, we need to not move and just build with that and just whatever ripples out and through. So that's what I would suggest. So do you have to sit for 8 hours a day? No. But whatever you do, if you can sit a little bit, even if you take a minute here and a minute there, 2 minutes there, you can play with that. And do you drive?
No.
Okay, so do you sit in the subway or train or something? That's an opportunity to sit with your eyes open. I wouldn't close them on the subway, but but you could just sit there and just be in your body and just notice, because that could be really helpful. And when I work, you know, people, when I work in the prisons and everything, just have, being able to be there and sit and be in your body and feel what's around you, because sometimes you can prevent yourself from being in danger just by paying attention to being in the body and let the body speak to you, and you can start to feel the vibe when it's not safe. So there's a lot you can do, and it's not like you have to close your eyes. You can practice your eyes open, just sitting and breathing. If you want to take deeper in breaths, just breathe and feel the body and notice what it feels like when you're sitting and breathing and just knowing that. You're riding the subway and you're just knowing that. Do you think that's something you could try? Thank you. Anyone else? Yes, ma'am.
So when intending to move through the world with love and compassion, I find that oftentimes it can rub up against expectations of what is always nice. And compassion and being nice can be very, very different. And it doesn't always, and I may not be doing it skillfully, but it's not always taken as love and compassion, which isn't nice, because I find that sometimes for me, compassion might, it can be tough. It's not always easy.
Okay, so what is the question? The question is that sounds like the duties practices is challenging because you don't feel authentic when you're doing them.
I find that compassion doesn't always translate because it isn't always nice.
Give me an example. Give me an example, because it sounds like you're pretending to be nice.
holding boundaries with someone and not being maybe as open.
Oh, you mean somebody that you don't trust or you don't feel comfortable with?
Yeah, and so you may not, for me, it seems like compassion at times is what's moving yourself or the other person further away from suffering, whereas just being nice is very quick and easy and kind of can be flaky. Does that make sense?
Yeah, would you like somebody to behave to you like that? Okay, so that tells you something, right? So I'm not sure I understand your definition of compassion, but here's what I would say. Compassion can be just tolerating the other person, or there's a compassion practice called just like me. Sometimes looking at the person and say, just like me, this person wants to be happy. Just like me, this person experiences loneliness, sadness, or whatever it is. But it's not like thou shalt do compassion practice. It's something that you can play with, and you know, if it doesn't feel right, or why start with a difficult person? Find somebody that's easy to be compassionate with or to, and then deal with that and feel that and master that before you get to the difficult person. It makes sense, but huh? Okay. My dad told me something about that one. He said, if you don't have anything nice to say, don't say anything. Or you say, hi, how you doing? And just, but to fake it and to say it, because even if you say it, they know it's not legit or they know it's not authentic. So to me, it sounds like, how do you interact with somebody you're uncomfortable with? Or that you're supposed to be kind? I'm not really understanding your question.
Trying to work through challenging situations with people that might be crossing boundaries.
Okay. Oh, that's simple. You put it down. No. with compassion. Yeah, I love you, but no. Or I don't know you that well. Whatever it is, but you got to self-protect. And with all the compassion you have, say no. Or you're in my space. Excuse me. It's not okay. See, because that's the self-love part of it, is can you be able to do that? And you can mean what you say without being mean when you say it. But you got to say no. You can put the boundary down. But that's different because you have to have self-integrity. What I mean by that is you keep people that shouldn't be in your space, or they cross a boundary, you got to let them know, no, that's not okay. So you don't have to be nice to them while they're crossing. No, no way you be nice to them when they're doing that. You got to say, dude, get out of here or whatever. Not happening. So anyway, on that compassionate response, because you're also being compassionate to them if you think about it when you set a boundary, because that might be enough for them to realize that they don't have any boundaries and they're being inappropriate with other people. So that's another way of looking at it. So can we just sit for a minute, because I know we're out of time. And just know that good friends and suitable conversation, you've been doing that for about 9 to 10 days now. And so you know how to do that. May we all be safe and protected. May we all be peaceful. May we all live with joy and ease. Walking now.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.